Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Chapter 24. How much for that doggie? A large, gold-painted statue of a lion guards the entrance to a city oasis, which is appropriately named Lions Park. It sits squarely in the center of town. The homeless had been using it as a shelter at night, sleeping under the metal bleachers of the softball fields. But early morning joggers, aghast at seeing humans lying on the ground covered by dirty blankets, complained, and soon routine police patrols and locked gates kept the destitute out. The park was heaven for my little dog Willow. A grand spread of well-watered green grass for rolling, tall trees for shade, and a constant cool breeze off the saltwater channel on which it was located, all made for a perfect place to the canine mind. Willow knew where we were going blocks before we were in sight of the lion because she could smell the park. She would begin a dance of ecstasy, hopping back and forth between my lap and the passenger seat as I drove. This is exactly what she was doing one late July morning as we pulled into the park after breakfasting at Sally's. I pulled the van to a stop under a shade tree about 8:30. The park was nearly empty. Willow was the first out the door as soon as I cracked it open. She was off to smell the world. I closed the door and hustled to catch up with her as she hurried from tree to tree, sniffing and marking the territory. But the troubles of the day were on my mind, and I couldn't seem to shake them enough to fully share her bliss. The prevailing thought as I walked along was, what in the hell am I going to do? My gas gauge was nearly empty. Maybe the tank held enough to get to the nearest filling station. But that was about it, and I didn't have two nickels to rub together. I was going to have to find money on the ground, or have it fall out of the sky, just to keep going. I had not felt this low and desperate in months, and I didn't want to have to beg again. I had hoped to run in to see at Sally's and ask for a few dollars, but he must have slept in. Then I thought I would see the major who could provide some assistance, but he was out begging for money himself to keep Sally's doors open. Willow could usually feel my distress, but even she was slow on the uptake this morning. We were, after all, at the park at this moment, and it was a beautiful morning. She threw herself to the ground and rolled in the grass, then got up and ran with the wind at her back until some other smell filled her nostrils and brought her to a halt. My task was just to follow along behind and watch out for predators, like pit bulls or the animal control truck, that could spoil this frolic for her. These visits to the park were the best thing I could do for her. Often I felt bad that she had gotten stuck tagging me along with me on this journey, having to sleep in a cold car, having to stay in the car while I ate at Sally's or at a local church, seldom getting a bath, and never getting the pampering she had received as a puppy. I considered trying to find her a comfortable home, one that was warm in the winter and cool in the summer, with a soft couch to rest on. A couple of cars were pulling in as Willow began leading me back toward the shade and the cup of water she knew awaited her in the van. As we approached our ride, a man in a big new truck pulled in right beside us. He was talking on his cell phone and had left his motor running. It was a diesel club cab 4x4, and he had to talk loudly to be heard over the engine. "Can you hear me now?" he asked the party on the other end of his connection. "Good. I just pulled into this city park down by the water. The reception is much better here. Anyway, I expect the Johnsons to call me this morning. Tell them the price has gone up to $380,000 for that house on Rocky Point. We've got three potential buyers." He quit talking for a moment. Then he turned off the engine and began to step out. "Wait a minute, you're breaking up. I'm getting out of the truck so I can hear you better," he said. "Okay, I can hear you now." He was pressing the phone closer to his ear and walked away from the truck. "Well, I'll have to take care of that when I get back." He pulled a pack of cigarettes from his pocket and then pulled one out and lit it. "I already stopped by the Martins this morning and let them know they are going to have to cough up another $20,000 for that place on Pine Road." He paused, taking a drag on his cigarette. "And before I forget it, my travel agent is supposed to drop off the tickets for the Cancun cruise. I'm heading out to Gold Mountain to play golf. I've got an 11 o'clock tee-off time. I'll stop in the office at 6 to look over those papers. Just leave them on my desk. Willow had jumped into the van to get her drink of water, and I had spent those few moments summoning the courage to walk around the van and ask the man for help. He snapped his cell phone shut, tossed his cigarette to the ground, and snuffed it out with his foot. He was already reaching for the door handle, and his back was to me as I nervously spoke up. "Sir, I hate to bother you, but I'm having a tough time right now." He turned to look at me. "I need to borrow $5 for gas to put in my van." The words seemed to tumble out of my mouth, and I had a sinking feeling that I had asked the wrong person. "What's the deal?" he asked. "It's a long story," I said, "but I lost my home, my job, and a lot more, and I'm living in my van now." His eyes traveled to the van, where Willow was now sticking her head out the window. "I don't like to give money to street people," he said. "I always think it goes to alcohol or drugs." "I don't drink or do drugs," I said, hoping that I sounded convincing, even though I was feeling labeled and judged. "I sell real estate for a living," he said. "I'm trying to rebuild the city by bringing people in here who have money. People like you hanging around just lower the property values. And if people just give you money, you'll just keep hanging around." For some reason, he felt the need to explain his position to me. "This town is on the way up," he continued. "The trouble is that there are too many low-income and homeless people for too long. We need people to buy out the poor and fix up these slums and let the poor move down to California or Oregon or to wherever we'll take them. You know what they call this town over in Seattle? They call it Bummer Town." I knew it all too well. I just stood there, feeling completely defeated. The man looked at Willow and asked, "That your dog?" "Yes," I said. "That's Willow. Willow, my van, and some clothes. That's all I have left." "How much did you pay for that dog?" It seemed like an odd question, but I decided to answer. "She cost $600 when she was a puppy," I said. He stepped closer to the passenger side of the van, where Willow was standing on the seat with her front paws on the door. "Will it bite me if I reach out to pet it?" he asked. "No," I said. The thought of Willow biting anyone almost made me laugh. He reached out cautiously to pat her head. Willow accepted his attention, then jumped down and over into the driver's seat. "How much do you want for that dog now?" he asked, looking directly at me. His question caught me off guard. I was silent. "My daughter might just like a little dog like this," he said. "Cleaned up, it might be kind of cute." "I really need the money, but I couldn't sell my dog." He laughed and shook his head, and then he reached into his pocket and pulled out a money clip. He slowly peeled a $100 bill from the clip and held it out. "Here, I'll give you $100 for that dog right now." I shook my head. He used his thumb and forefinger to get another $100 from the clip. "How about $200? "No, thanks." "Okay," he said, looking at Willow again. "Does it have all its shots?" he asked. "She's due. It's been maybe 2 years since she's seen a vet," I said. "Well then," he said, "I'll tell you what I'll do." He took two more $100 bills from the clip. "I'll give you $400 for it. That should get you down the road and buy a few nights in a motel." "$400. That's my last offer." I stared at the money in his outstretched hand. "Thanks for the offer," I said. Then I looked him straight in the face. "But I can't sell her. She's my friend. I couldn't sell her at any price." The man left again. Then he tucked the money back into his money clip and put it in his pocket. "Everything is for sale," he said. "Houses, boats, cars, and people too. It's just a matter of price. That's what I've learned." Then he turned away. "Good luck," he said, getting into the truck and starting the engine. He looked over his shoulder and backed out, turned his truck around, and pulled away. I stared after him for a moment. I was shaken. A part of me wanted to argue with him and convince him he was wrong, that everything was not for sale, that everyone did not have a price. But a small part of me wasn't all that sure. And maybe that was the difference between the haves, at least those who flaunted what they have, and the have-nots, that sense of certainty that they have the answers to all the questions of life. I wasn't too sure they even had the right questions. I wondered at what point on this journey the Wheeler dealers traded in their sensitivity, their caring, and their compassion for the cockiness of those who are able to carry and flash a large roll of bills. It occurred to me that in some ways, perhaps, no, I was certain, I had a lot more real value than the man in this truck. I didn't have money for gas, but I did have Willow. And desperate as I might be feeling otherwise, I still had the comfort of some dignity. I stepped over to the van, resolving to wait until someone else pulled in so I could try again. "Come on, Willow," I said to my friend, opening the door. "Let's take another walk." She cocked her head and gave me a sideways look, then jumped from the seat onto the pavement. I closed the door as we headed for the grass. She knew what was valuable, too. Willow stayed right at my feet as we walked across the asphalt. The thought of being without her had unnerved me. "Geez, Willow," I said, looking down at her, "you're worth more than I am. But you know I couldn't sell you, not for $1 million. As soon as our feet hit the grass, Willow lowered her nose and was off again, following a new scent. I let her race ahead, and I walked slowly along the outfield fence of one of the softball fields. As I passed center field, I saw a softball lying in the grass ahead. I walked over and picked it up. It was an almost new ball that must have been hit over the barrier the night before and left behind. I tossed the ball up in the air a few times as I walked behind Willow. She raced over to the fence to smell a piece of folded-up paper lying next to the chain links. The paper was just inside the fence and maybe blown there by the wind. I bent down to retrieve it and unfolded it carefully to find "lineup" written at the top. Then Bob, second base; Jim, first; Larry, shortstop; Steve, third. And tucked inside the paper were two $10 bills. Some player had obviously put his lineup card and his hot dog and beer money in his back pocket and then lost it. I smiled at our good fortune as I put the money in my pocket. It was all we needed to keep us going for another day. Chapter 26. A Room with a View. Well, well, well. We are so fortunate this morning to be joined by the Mayor of Bremerton, chimed C, leaning back in his chair. John, the subject of C's jesting commentary, had just shuffled into Sally's for breakfast this Friday morning, which was the beginning of Labor Day weekend. He pointed a finger at C, closed one eye, and used his thumb as a make-believe hammer of a gun as he pretended to shoot C. "Gotcha," he said, smiling, and turned to pick up his tray and receive his breakfast portion for the day. C had given John the moniker "the Mayor of Bremerton" a long time ago, because not only had John lived in Bremerton all his life, but he had lived in Bremerton. John must have been 60-something, and he looked a little like Captain Kangaroo. His white hair was cut in that same Dutch fashion, though not quite as neatly styled, and he had a near-white mustache. His right eye was almost half-closed from an injury he received while working at the naval yard as a young man. On fire watch, he had stood near the welders as they made repairs on the massive aircraft carriers in the shipyard, keeping his eyes open for stray sparks that could lead to disaster. It was one of those sparks that damaged John's eye. John was a walking encyclopedia of Bremerton history and enjoyed spinning yarns about the town with a touch of Will Rogers' wit. He had played the trombone in the high school band, which had regaled every ship entering and leaving the yard. He knew about the secret tunnels under the shipyard and all the dirty laundry about past and present politicians and other local notables. C and I were sitting at the table nearest the serving line in the company of Willie the Walker. He was an extremely quiet man, maybe 70 years old, who was nicknamed for his brisk walks from one side of town to the other every day, carrying a small plastic bag in each hand. I'd heard Willie would fill the bags with abandoned newspapers, rolls of toilet paper from restaurant washrooms, and other things he could use at home. John, his tray now filled with a bowl of malto meal, a cinnamon roll, a hard-boiled egg, and a cup of Java, turned his springly step toward our table. He was wearing his usual smile. "May I join you, gentlemen?" he asked, placing his tray on the table.
"Of course, Mr. Mayor," said C.
"Well, I see you somehow lived through another night," John said, looking intently at C. "For the life of me, I don't know how." C just laughed and picked up his cinnamon roll.
"John, look at this. I think I see the face of Jesus in this cinnamon roll."
John rolled his one good eye, then peered at C's roll.
"It could be," he replied, cocking his head slightly. "Sally's is a church, you know."
Then he picked up his own roll and looked at it.
"Mine looks a little like Donald Trump."
He bit into it. "But it tastes like it's a week-old cinnamon roll. You know, a cinnamon roll with the image of Jesus on it could be worth some money," I said.
Willie looked at his roll intently.
He turned it from side to side and then all the way around before slowly sliding it into one of the bags sitting on the floor beside him.
"Well, what's the latest?" C asked,
as John attempted to guide a spoonful of cereal past his mustache.
What John didn't know about Bremerton probably wasn't worth knowing. He had lived in the same house for all his 60-plus years, a big two-story house with a large front porch, less than half a block from Sally's, across 6th Street. It was smack dab in the center of town, by the A1 auto repair and a drive-through bank directly across the street from Monica's Social Club, a well-known, brightly lit watering hole that served beer in big, frosty mugs. John swallowed his porridge and wiped his mouth with a napkin.
"You mean you haven't seen today's newspaper?" he asked.
"No," said C.
"Well, now they want to spend $30 million to build a tunnel under the city to take traffic away from downtown. That's after spending millions over the last 30 years to get people to come downtown," John huffed.
"Where are they going to get all that money?" I asked.
"I'm sorry," John said, leaning toward me. "I didn't hear what you said. I happened to be sitting on his bad ear side."
"Where's the money coming from?" I said, a little louder.
John looked at our other tablemate and asked, "Willie, did you get a paper today?" Willie, without a peep, picked up one of his bags and laid it on the table. Then he pulled out a stack of papers, the New York Times, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, USA Today, and the Kitsap Sun. He silently handed the Sun across the table to John.
"Thank you, Willie," said John. "Willie gets these to do the crossword puzzles," he said as an aside. "He's a wizard at them."
Willie just smiled.
"Now that's C," said John, snapping the paper open. "Headline, Dix encourages city to accept tunnel money," John read. "Story, Congressman Norm Dix has encouraged the city to accept grant money from the federal government to build a 6-block-long tunnel under the city that will ease traffic congestion during the departure and arrival of Washington State ferries. The city needs to accept the grant as soon as possible or risk it being taken away in the next budget session," Dix said. John folded the paper and handed it back to Willie.
"For heaven's sakes, why don't they take that money and build a recreation center right here, downtown, with some showers for the homeless people to get cleaned up, and maybe a pool table or two, and a place for some free movies? A room with some books would be nice, too, where somebody can sit down and read. We need some place for the poorest of the poor to go besides begging for enough change to get a beer at Monica's and walking down the alleys at night."
"Hear, hear," chimed C. "That's why I call you the mayor."
"Oh, don't get me started," John replied. He cracked his hard-boiled egg on the oval table and began to pick away at the shell.
"Look at that Congressman Norm Dickhead center going up down the street," he grumbled. "What a monstrosity that is."
C broke into a laugh.
"Did you just call our congressman Dickhead?" he asked.
Even Willie could not contain himself and started giggling.
It's going to cost $30 million for a government building to house a bunch of paper pushers, John continued, peeling his egg. Why didn't they just buy the old Eagle Hardware building on the other side of town? There are thousands of square feet of empty space in town. It's just pork, pork, and more pork money from the feds. This little piggy developer gets some, this little piggy banker gets some, and this little piggy real estate firm gets some. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. They could have taken some of those millions to build a homeless shelter, maybe with a free medical clinic and a dentist or two to help fix up some of our rotten teeth. Jesus, John. Somebody's going to call you a communist or at least a socialist. C leaned forward as he accentuated the titles. Or maybe you are the worst of the worst, John, a liberal, he added. Well, I'm no communist or socialist, John replied, but if helping the poor and the sick and the oppressed makes me a liberal, then I guess I am one, and I'm damn proud of it. I'm in good company, too. Jesus believed in helping the poor. He must have been a liberal, too. John had finally finished peeling his egg. He reached to the middle of the table for the salt and pepper shakers. He delicately salted the egg and added just a dash of pepper. Just as he was putting the egg to his mouth, C asked, What about those waterfront condos they are building right down by the new convention center and hotel? John drew the egg back from his mouth and shook his head. I don't understand it. That's a housing and urban development project. I thought HUD was supposed to build affordable housing for the poor. Some of those condos are going for $1 million each. That's not affordable housing to me. That's how convoluted our government has become. Oh, the bureaucrats can rationalize and tell you that spending is going to create jobs and make the city better, but the homeless and the poor won't get any of those jobs. The big construction companies will come in and build the condos and leave, and the rich will buy them. The poor and the homeless will still be poor and homeless as they walk by those condos. Something is rotten in the state of Denmark, John concluded as he popped the egg into his mouth. Without saying a word, Willie picked up a bag in each of his hands and shuffled off toward the door. Do you need a ride somewhere? I asked C. No, a ship came in last night, and I'm going to hang around downtown for a bit to see what's going on, he replied. He picked up his tray and turned to go clean it off. I'll probably see you later, he said over his shoulder. That left John and me at the table. I'll see you later, Mayor, C tossed in as he passed our table again on the way to the door. John picked up his cup of coffee and took a sip. Some little bird told me that you were writing a book, he said to me. Well, yes and no, I said. I've started a book, but I don't know if I will ever finish it. I feel like throwing it away sometimes. It's not very good. What's it about? He asked. It's about homeless people, I responded. John raised his bushy eyebrows. Well, you have a wealth of good copy in this town, he said. But whatever you do, don't put anything I said about the city in your book. People here don't like to be criticized. I took a sip of my now cold coffee. I also heard you're still living in your car. That right? John asked next. Yeah, I am. It's been over a year now. I've been sleeping up in the Methodist Church parking lot most of the time, sometimes at the Episcopal Church, just me and my little dog. Well, I've got a room at my place if you're interested, said John. Oh, I'm interested, all right, I replied, but I don't have any money. How much would it cost? I've got 5 people living there now, he began, but I've never rented this room. It used to be my room when I was a kid. It looks out over the street. I've been just using it to store stuff. We would have to move some stuff around to make it habitable, but we can do that. It's better than sleeping in your car, and your dog can sleep there too. As far as money goes, well, let's say you can give me what you can when you can. How about that? Maybe you'll get rich off your book. Wow, that's generous of you. I was a little stunned and more than a little wary. After my close encounter of a very unusual kind with Tina and her trailer, I wondered if this was another offer that was just too good to be true. Would I be evicted tomorrow if someone else came along who was able to pay? At least it would be a bed for tonight, or maybe even for a few nights. Come on, let's go take a look at it, he said, standing up. We walked out of Sally's together. I'll grab Willow, I said, and walked quickly to the van. I opened the door and picked her up in my arms to carry her to John's house. I didn't know much about John, I thought, as we walked to the corner and waited for the traffic light. As he was pointing out things of interest in the neighborhood, the bank on the corner that was built about 10 years ago, the auto repair shop that came a year later when they tore down the Miller house, I was thinking about the many times I had seen him around town. He drove a brown and black late-60s Volkswagen bus that he had obviously been patching up over the years. It would putt and sputter and occasionally backfire as he would arrive with 5 or 6 hungry people to a free church dinner. He generally gave his riders tour guide service over the sound of the engine, often pointing out which bridge was built when, what year the local college opened, and where he had gone to school. "Here's home," John said as we reached his house in the middle of the block. We climbed up the steps to a big porch. It was a turn-of-the-century Victorian home. "I was born in this house in 1938, he said, reaching in his pocket for a ring full of keys. He selected one and slid it in the lock. "Everybody else uses the back entrance," he said, "but since your room is right up at the top of the stairs, you can use the front. It's right above the porch here. You'll have to remember to lock the door every time, though. Sometimes people hang around on the porch at night. My room is clear in the back, and I can't hear them out here." It was dark inside. Shades were pulled down in the living room. "This way," John said, as he grabbed the rail of the dark mahogany staircase and began climbing the stairs. I followed. The staircase made a turn at the top, and we arrived at the second floor. John looked through his keys again, picked out another, and turned it in the lock. He opened the door and flipped the light switch. One bare bulb hung from a patched-up light fixture on the ceiling, which blinked a couple of times before it came on. "I'll have to fix that someday," John muttered, pointing to a fixture. That's tonight's episode. At this point, we must break off our reading. You've been hearing Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Copyright 2009. It is read with the permission of Skyhorse Publishing of New York. Join us next time on The Bookshelf for Breakfast at Sally's. The Bookshelf is produced by Vern Windham. I'm Jeff Hazen.